When people say, like, what is the power of empathy and what does that actually do as a skill and what can it lead to? And the ultimate answer is world peace. Empathy Week has reached 1.3 million students across 54 countries. Our film program, which is a more intense thing, has been completed by 175,000 students. People think of, like, empathy as maybe a value, or they think it as something that you have, you're born with, a trait, exactly. But we define it as a skill because you can train it and you can get better at it. You can also lose it. Research has also shown, like, there's an organization, Catalyst, in America, that they've done research that shows if you have an empathetic leader or manager, everything improves. Imagery can be so powerful in changing people's perspectives on things. Empathy ultimately allows you to navigate the world so much better, and it also allows you to navigate change better. And we are living in a world with tech advancements, change is happening so much.
Do you think it's possible that we can have world peace? Today's guest thinks we can. I'm joined by the founder of Empathy Week and Empathy Studios, Ed Kerwin, as he discusses the great work he's doing with regards to empathy and why we all need a little bit more of it in our lives. This is a special, special episode, guys. You're going to enjoy it. Over to the show. Hi guys, welcome to another episode of What My Best Friend Does, where we talk to best friends in the hope of inspiring you to take immediate action to find the career of your dreams. Today, I'm talking to the founder of Empathy Week and Empathy Studios, Ed Kerwin. Ed, how you doing, bro?
Doing very well. Thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. We love to start with an icebreaker on this podcast. What did you want to be growing up?
Oh my gosh, what did I want to be growing up? Do you know what? I didn't actually know.
Yeah?
I just thought I wanted to do something I was interested in. To be fair, when I first started getting through school and things, I was thinking medicine, doctor. I was interested in science. I think that was because I was pushed on the sort of academic side by my parents.
Yeah.
But also loved the practical nature of it. So it was like the practical academic subject. So that's, I suppose, something in medicine, doctor, something that involved people.
Yeah.
At the start.
Okay. Nice, nice. So wanted to do something in medicine. You've now founded, Empathy Studios and Empathy Week. So, like, before we get into it, like, I read the report that Empathy Studios did in collaboration with the University of Cambridge, mm-hmm. where it spoke about the importance of empathy skills training. And right at the end of the report, there's a quote from you. And you say, I believe that empathy is the single most important skill for humans in the future. Like, I just wanted to start there. Like, why? Why is it the single most important skill for humans in future? And then, let's start there.
And I would say now as well, okay. Obviously. So I think if you're listening or watching, thing that I would say is, like, think about what a skill that you've been told that you want to develop or that you think is going to be vital for your success in both professional and personal life. And often that could lead to something like, right, I want to be a great leader. I want to be really creative. I want to be a great communicator or explainer. I want to be really resilient. Essentially, all of these skills fall away without a foundation of empathy. Mm-hmm. And I think ultimately I also probably need to sort of define empathy, and we have lots of people define empathy in various ways. Think of it a bit like leadership. Leadership is defined in so many different ways by so many different people. But for us, if you took a one word definition or a synonym of empathy, it would be understanding. Mm-hmm. And so ultimately, if you can build that skill of being able to understand yourself and other people, you will be able to connect with people better. You will be able to navigate difficult situations better, be better at emotionally regulating yourself. You know, think about at work, maybe that person that's pissed you off a little bit. You don't respond to them straight away with the email. You maybe think about from their perspective, maybe something's happened, maybe you can change your language. Empathy ultimately allows you to navigate the world so much better, and it also allows you to navigate change better. And we are living in a world with tech advancements, change is happening so much. So that is why we say empathy is the most important skill, because ultimately it's important for your well-being, it's important for your professional advancement. And ultimately, it's at the foundation of all the relationships that you have, that understanding, that ability to connect.
I love that. I love that. So I needed to start there. But now we've got that understanding, like, let's take it way, way back. Like, can you talk to me about, like, how did you start empathy, or even the jobs you had before, right? Because you started as a teacher and then you got into the filmmaking. Yeah, like, can you take us on your journey to the point where we're at now, where you founded Empathy Week and Empathy Studios?
So, like, even jobs as a kid?
Not jobs as a kid. Let's go with, like, well,
babe around, working in the kitchen, working in a pub, stacking shelves.
You went to university?
Went to university. So, I went to the University of Bath. To study biochemistry.
Okay.
It was a way of sort of seeing if I wanted to get into medicine, and essentially loved uni, probably because I just played basketball most of the time and skipped a few lectures. But that led me to also, during my university degree, I also did a placement. So I did a year placement in industry, which is why I kind of chose Bath, because I think like 96% of students do a year in industry.
Yeah.
And they've got really great connections. And I was like, right, this is a great way to start and see, do I like science? So I spent a year in a lab. Absolutely hated it. I was one of those people, you know, on BBC News, when they see, you see the guy pipetting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was me a year. And I hated it. And I'm such a people person that I was just like stuck in this lab. And they always tell you that, you know, you're working in a team and across. It's lies. You've got headphones in. You're pipetting volumes you can't even see. And I just kept killing all of the stuff that I was researching. So I was terrible at that, but I learned that I was terrible, and that's better than going into 3 years and doing that. And when I was there, they said, oh, do you want to maybe do some school out? I was that bad. They were like, do you want to do some school outreach?
Yeah.
I said, yeah, go on then. And I realized, oh, I quite like this. And then I applied for Teach First, which is a, I don't know if they call it a grad scheme anymore, but it was at the time very much so, which was like, basically, we'll take you from uni in 6 weeks, train you up, and we'll put you into a classroom.
Teach First is only 6 weeks?
I thought
it was like a whole year or 2 years.
So they do 2 years, but you enter the classroom
after six weeks,
completely on your own. You don't have no other support teachers. So if you do a normal PGC at a university, or if you're a training provider, you will spend a lot of that time in your PGC year doing lectures, but then being in the classroom, taking parts of lessons, like being smoothed into running your own lessons. I left uni in June. I trained in end of June and July, had 4 weeks off in August, September. I was on a 16-hour timetable out of 25 lessons, so 16 hours a week, all on my own classes. And you just, it's like sink or swim.
Bloody
hell. And loads of people done it, and it is intense, but I loved it. That's how I got into teaching.
So just, so Teach First, like, did it have to be science, or could you have
anything? So primary school, you can teach history, maths, they do.
And you just decide at the start of the program what it is you want to go into?
Or? Yeah, they have like a kind of, I guess, a quota of, they're trying to fill X amount of spots in X subjects. But science is one that's always sought after.
Okay.
Became a science teacher.
Okay, so you became a science teacher. How long did you end up doing that for?
3 years. And the kind of, so 1,600 students in this school in North London, in Enfield, and absolutely loved teaching. But yeah, went up. I mean, I started when I was 22. I was also a sick form co-tutor, so I learned off someone. But there was a kid in that class, in my form class, that was 19. It was literally 3 years younger than me.
Yeah.
As I was teaching, he's like in sick form.
Yeah.
So I like lied about my age. Luckily, I had a beard. I've always had a beard. Like, I've been able to grow a beard quite young.
Yeah.
And I remember telling them at the end of that year like how old I were, and they were just like, oh my gosh.
You're one of us, sir.
Yeah, sir.
Or they're just like, Ed.
So, no, but did that for 3 years, became a head of chemistry within my sort of second year. And I would like to think, you know, it's because I was amazing. I wouldn't say I was bad, but literally like, no one else went for it. And I was like, I'm going to end up doing this anyway. So I had a lot of responsibility very early on, 23, 24. That was a lot of pressure, and teachers are under a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
The time, the impact, but at the same time, there is literally no job like it. Like, you could laugh and cry on the same day. Every day is going to be different. Doesn't really matter what you plan, because you've got to plan it, but then it will shift, it will change, and you're dealing with hundreds of, you know, each year I was teaching 250, maybe 200, 250 different humans. And you see them every week. Like, that's an immense amount of contact time with different people. And I think that's what spurred me on to my interest in empathy, because it's, you meet every type of person under the sun.
Yeah.
Every type of personality, every type of background, every type of religion, creed, ideas, whatever it is. And you see the best of diversity and humanity. And I think everyone should spend some time in a school at some point, because we kind of forget. I think we have an idea of what it was. Everyone's like, oh, you know, the amount of people that speak to me about education, and because they went to school, think their opinion is like really valid. I'm like, go back as a teacher on the other side, and you see a completely different perspective.
I love that. And so you did the 3 years, and you don't go straight into empathy, right? So yeah, what is it that triggers you to move on, shall we say? Mm. And yeah, what is it you go on to do next?
Yeah, I had a like sort of interim 2 years, I suppose, where I was just so when I got to my third year of teaching and I was 25, I was like, I've actually been in education my whole life. Never took a gap year.
Yeah,
you know, I had a very privileged upbringing, don't get me wrong, but got to 18, went straight to uni, straight out of, in uni, did a year working. And then also straight out of uni, pretty much 4 weeks holiday, and then straight into teaching, because I had all that training in between as well. I thought, I'm 25. I've never chosen when I can go on holiday or when I can take time off or do things. And I was like, okay. And I was doing a part-time master's whilst I was teaching. That's probably why I was tired. And I had to write this like 20,000 word dissertation over summer. And it was just a junction point where the head teacher in the school was changing. I'd taken a sixth form group of students the whole way through their sixth form, and I would be getting a new group, and I was like, oh, if I stay, I'm only going to stay another year, so I don't want to break up their time. And then I got an opportunity also to, it doesn't exist anymore, I don't think, but Department for International Development, they had a fund that basically enabled young British people who were under 25 or under, so I was at that cap, to go to work with various charities, organisations, in international development. And I got one that was placed in Uganda, and it was working with entrepreneurs. And what I loved about this one was they really taught you about voluntourism, you know, like the white saviorism and all of that stuff. And they were like really anti it, weren't allowed to go into orphanage. It was all about, you are connected with entrepreneurs there, it's their business too, so you don't come and tell them change everything, you're there to help guide them. And then they matched you with local Ugandans in the same position as you, so it was like 50-50. And that, I mean, you live with a local family, six kids. The first night I remember eating rice, and I think it was just rice and cabbage, and I was like, oh no. And I'm sleeping in an outbuilding next to the chicken cage, and the long drop, and just like the whole, you know, your whole world shifts.
How long did you not doing that for?
That was 3 months.
Wow.
And that was like, you know, I think took, what I've learned, I've done a lot of traveling since, is it kind of takes you 2 weeks to adjust to anywhere, I think, if you're living there for a period of time. But that was incredible. Learned a lot about myself, but about another culture. You know, I was actually recounting a story of, you know, I'd never come across a jackfruit before.
I don't know what jackfruit is. It sounds it's like a grapefruit, right?
Or no, it's like you can get massive ones. Okay. It's like this. In the UK, they tin it and it's like white and it's like raw, and they cook with it. Okay. Like vegans cook with it. As like, it's kind of like a pulled pork. You can make it into pulled pork texture. Okay. But if you try and do that there, they would like frown upon you.
Yeah.
But it's actually like a really, really sweet, quite sappy. I don't know how to describe it, but it's delicious. But you can get massive ones. I remember carrying it back from town, and we were in this place called Iganga, which is a town of 50,000, sort of marketplace. We were really, you know, I was probably like one of 20 white people there. And I was walking with Tina, my host sister, who's Ugandan. And we were walking back 30 minutes with this and I was carrying this jackfruit. And then just like all the men at the side of the road were just like laughing and being like, really? Hey, Mzungu, it's like white man, laughing. And I was like, why are they laughing at me? It's just like, you're a white man carrying a jackfruit. It's like, that's only done by like women who are Ugandan. They've never seen a foreigner probably carry a jackfruit. They've never seen a man probably carry a jackfruit. And it's just little things like that that I was doing. And I got back from then Uganda and those amazing experiences. And then I was like, I want to do a project. I managed to get £500 from like a youth fund, bought a camera. And what I was really passionate about, I think, when I was teaching was a cause.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it was homelessness. So I did assemblies on homelessness, knowing that some of my students were also experiencing homelessness.
Really?
Not in the sense of like on the street, but in temporary accommodation, hidden homeless, as we would say. And I just was curious. I'd started earning money, moved back home with my parents. Not really a cool thing to do. In fact, I've done that again at 30, like being an entrepreneur struggling.
Yeah, yeah. You've got to do what you've got to
exactly,
do.
Exactly. You've got to, like, honestly. And then started doing tutoring online, tutoring in person, and ending up... look back now, it's like, for no money, was just doing projects because I was curious, because I wanted to. So I was offering, I wasn't really that good, but I was learning how to use a camera. Shout out to YouTube University and everyone that's
we've had a few managed. Of them on.
Yeah. Honestly, YouTube, unreal.
Yeah.
Unreal. And I was like, to these grassroots organizations, hey, I can take some photos or follow you around or do some stuff. And I traveled to, made a little sort of mini doc, I suppose, or different videos, and then gave those to organizations, learned a lot about them. It led to me doing a TED talk, actually a TEDx talk. I called it Motivation of the Invisible. My idea was essentially, you don't ever see the story of people that are in the middle of homelessness.
Mm.
You often hear a sad story at the end of people dying, or you see a story of someone who's come out of a charity. And obviously then it's like a charity ad rather than it being about their story. So I was like, how do I end up making something that is more authentic, that actually gets people on side? And also, from my teaching background, gives tangible impact to people that feel guilty or feel, you know, negative walking past on the street. So mm-hmm. Yeah, I was like, the call to action, well, what I learned was that you can still interact with someone on the street, say hello, don't have to feel guilty if you don't have anything to offer, and they will actually appreciate that.
100%.
So that led to that, and this now really leads into how I got into Empathy Week and Empathy Studios and the Empathy Program. I met a man in Liverpool who runs an organization called Liverpool Homeless Football Club.
Yeah.
Simple idea. You start playing football, you bring people that are experiencing homelessness together. They feel community, they feel belonging.
100%.
They start to like take drugs less, or they start to drink less, or they start to be healthier, they start to access services,
yeah.
Change their life. And he was like, have you heard of the Homeless World Cup? And I was like, what? And I was like, no. And he was like, oh, this, but on a global scale. So yeah. Countries, people wearing their own kits.
And there's just been like a Netflix film on
What's the guy's name from Top Boy?
Michael Ward.
Yeah, he's in it.
I see it.
Bill Nighy.
The Beautiful Game.
I was crying through that because it is so, it like the boards on the side, the kit, like everything, even the lanyards, it's like exactly the same.
As you saw.
And they've even got people in the organization spread throughout the film. It's so good. But that, I went to Mexico, I just flew to Mexico to go and see it.
As you do.
I traveled, and I was like, I told myself I want to go traveling. Traveled around Mexico for 6 weeks on my own, cheaper than living. Like, you can get accommodation for like back in 2018 anyway, you could get accommodation in a hostel for £5 a night.
Yeah.
You can eat for like £5 a day. So did that, got to Mexico City, followed the Welsh team there, and then the Indian team were like, why are you here? I managed to get myself a freelance journalist badge. Yeah. I don't know how, just wrote to them.
Just networking.
Just taking a chance, really. And
Was there a lot of crowds at these games?
Yeah, so what is amazing about this is that they took over the centre of Mexico City, the Zocalo, the central square.
Yeah.
And it's four-a-side football, and they put like three little turf pitches up. But there's no tickets running, so people walk through.
Okay.
And they have like a ticket, you know, people counter. And it's like something like over 100,000 people walk through throughout the week.
And is it something that leads people out of homelessness? Because like they become like, I don't know, athletes or...
Well, that's the big thing. So, you know, especially with the Indian team or teams that come from real like... areas where the economy is so low anyway, but then they're also from poverty or they're from a homeless, you go, well, why don't you just give them the £2,000 that it would cost to take them there?
Yeah.
And basically I went out to India after this. The Indian team basically got me to go out and help develop a leadership program alongside their coaching program, because I'd done my leadership masters, I worked in education, I was working for another organization doing freelance facilitating. Mm-hmm. So they paid me to come out, and actually that's how Empathy Week sort of started. But Pankaj, who I made a film about his life. He'd played for the Indian team a few years ago and then started working for their organization called Slum Soccer.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him that question. I said, why would you rather have had the £2,000, which is a lot of money? His house, you know, in comparison, is made out of like partly mud.
Yeah.
And he said, no, of course, like it changed my whole mind, my perspective on life, everything. And he said, that is like, you can't put a price on that. And he's now, you know, living an amazing life and working hard and doing his own thing. And he would not have had that. He wouldn't have had that without that opportunity.
Okay, so you mentioned that you made a film about Pankaj. How does this film about Pankaj, how does that translate into Empathy Week? So yeah, I think we've got to a nice point. Yeah. Like, have you defined empathy earlier?
Mm.
have you always been an empathetic person? Is it something that's always been in your mind, or is it something that was developed through all of these experiences while you've traveled?
Yeah, definitely through all the experience and definitely through teaching. To give more of a like a rounded definition of empathy, we describe it as the skill to understand another and the ability to create space for someone to reveal their authentic self.
Yep.
So within that first bit of that full definition, the skill, like it's a trainable skill. People think of like empathy as maybe a value, or they think it as something that you have, you're born with, a trait, exactly. But we define it as a skill because you can train it and you can get better at it.
Yeah.
You can also lose it. And I think for me, the real interest in empathy came from, I had a group of young men that self-called the U-Gang. So in my third year of teaching, there were 24 young men that the school decided, let's put them all in one class, give them to Ed and another few teachers. They're all sort of failing, or you know, sometimes issues with police, whatever, sometimes not there. And they taught me a lot. They called themselves the U-Gang because at Christmas, they all got U's in their mocks and they came up the stairs chanting, U-Gang, U-Gang, U-Gang. You can imagine I'm stood there as a teacher waiting in the doorway for them to come through. And ultimately, you know, slightly pooing myself, but be like, oh God, you know, we're here. And they come through the door and then, you know, you switch on. You actually like, they're all chanting U-Gang because they want to belong.
Yeah.
And actually they're scared young men. They're scared of failing. They already think they're failures. They've been told they're failures for a lot of the years of their education. The thing I had in common with them was a love of basketball, which they found weird that I was a science geek and better than them at basketball. But I used that as kind of like, I'd be like, right, we can watch the top 10 plays from last night if we get this done.
Yeah.
And they taught me a lot about understanding. Of course, you're not going to do your work if you're one of six brothers and you've only got your mum and you haven't had breakfast and this has happened. And, you know, actually trying to understand them on a level where, right, actually, how do we do this? Galvanize them, get them together, get them to be a team. Mm-hmm. You know, I talked about us versus sort of the people that have expectations of us and not them, and actually bringing them together. And they actually, I wouldn't say this is just me, there's lots of teachers, great teachers involved in it, but they ended up with all without yous at the end of it. But they were a big sort of driver for me. Retrospectively, I would say, looking back, actually realizing I wouldn't have even called it empathy at the time, but I was thinking, how do they operate? What is it that makes them tick? Why are they acting the way they are?
Yeah.
And then once you establish that, you can establish, okay, how am I going to teach them science? How am I going to get them hooked on this? How am I going to enthuse them, galvanize them, realize that this is about their futures and they really only have kind of one big shot at it. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how I got the interest into empathy. And it was really through just, you know, you've heard how I've just navigated sort of those couple of years after leaving teaching of tasting different things. I knew I had to not put myself into something because I knew maybe opportunities would come. I lived at home. I barely earned that much money. I then reduced my social life. All my friends were in London. My parents live in Oxford. So I was like reducing that. But I knew that I had to do that to take opportunities and to do stuff. And at the time, people think you're so weird. Like, remember, imagine telling your friends, oh, I'm just doing a project. No one's paying me or no one's told me to do it.
Yeah.
But I'm staying in a hostel for two nights in Manchester for like a tenner. There's loads of weird people around me as well. But, and then like yourself thinking that's weird, but you do it because you've got a passion or a curiosity for something. Going to Mexico, no one's going to come with me. In fact, I spoke to the England team and they were like, oh, no, we don't need a videographer or whatever. And I was like, okay. And then I still booked and went and I saw they had one there. They obviously just didn't want me.
They just let you down kindly.
And they said at first they were interested. I was like, do you know what? I'm still going to go. And in that, if I hadn't have done that, I wouldn't have met the Indian team. The Indian team were then like, we'll pay for your flight and we'll keep you alive. And I was like, great, that's enough. I wasn't paid. I got flight paid, lived with a founder for three months in the middle of India, had an amazing time, met these people, and it was there that I decided, hang on a minute, my filmmaking's got to a point where I'm getting paid by people to do it. I look back on it now, obviously it was like 5-6 years ago, I'm like, oh. At the time I was like that, and I've got passion for education. The U-Gang, if I could have brought them to India with me, brains would have exploded. Most of them haven't been out of like Enfield, Edmonton or Tottenham. So imagine taking them to like here, and I was like, film is a way to transport them. And I just knew from all of my experience of teaching, I could create something that isn't being done in schools, that isn't about kindness and isn't about charity. It's not about, oh, I'm raising money. I'm not making a sad charity advert. I'm making films about people's lives and actually getting you to recognize that you are the same or not that different to this person.
So is that what Empathy Week was about?
It's Empathy Week started
about people's lives.
So that's how it started. We've now turned it into, what's come out of that is that we've turned Empathy Week actually into a festival.
Okay.
And I've built out Empathy Studios. So okay. Empathy Studios now is our sort of umbrella organization. We are an education and creative studio. So, and we use the power of film to develop skill of empathy.
Okay.
So we do that in organizations. So we train some organizations in skill of empathy. We use film to do that. We train teachers, CPD training for them, getting them used to that skill and how they could navigate issues and behavior and all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
And in our program, we have an empathy program, which the Cambridge Research is based on. That sits at the foundation. That's like our main product that we sell across schools. Empathy Week now sits as kind of our annual festival. So we've made it a non-profit a community interest company, and that's a festival that any school anywhere in the world can access, and it happens every year in sort of February, March.
And what happens during that festival?
So I'll give you an example last year because we're planning this year, but we have a theme. So last year the theme was home, this year the theme is what's your spark.
Mm-hmm.
Getting young people to think about what it is that makes them tick. So last year we had some in-person events. So we had like 400 kids in a school from different schools doing an Empathy Week live show,
mm-hmm.
which included film and media and other things. We did a teacher training for teachers at Canva in London. So we got sponsored by Canva. And then on the Friday, we had an in-person event for 60 sixth formers from six different schools. So they did, and that was at Snapchat HQ.
Wow.
So we partnered with some big organizations. Make it exciting, you know, really get the, and you see the kids, like a couple of girls that came into the Snap HQ in Farringdon, and they went to the toilet, because I don't know what, you know, girls' obsession with toilets. They went to the mirrors.
And they've never seen something mirrors, like right? it, have they?
They came out and went, have you seen the toilets? And I was like, what are you all about? I was like, the mirrors, they're so big. They're like, and I was just like, oh my gosh, like, this is the first time they've seen a corporate building, which to be fair, it is a nice
corporate building,
as you would expect.
Yeah,
but still, their minds were like blown. And then they see like a Snap employee walk past, and she's wearing a hijab. And then the girls that were in it, you like see them nudge each other. That for me, that's empathy, right?
Yeah.
The understanding of a different world, a perspective, and you see them ask questions because they could never picture themselves
in that position,
being a Muslim girl wearing a hijab, working at Snap. And then there was this young lad, Brian, who I interviewed as well at some point. He was like, yeah, he had the deepest voice as well for like a 14-year-old, 15-year-old boy. Yeah. He was just like, yeah, I thought it was just going to be a load of old men coding away. I didn't realise it was going to be all these cool young people, creative ideas, or you can work in all these. And they got this sense of like, you know, the business. And then they were challenged. So I did like an empathy session, skill session with them. And then they were challenged to come up with a better, like, how could you make the Snap app better at connecting humans? And then they pitched in front of people, and then
wow.
the winners went away with the Snap lens glasses that you can't even buy now.
Yeah.
So they're like premium products, and they were just like, their minds were blown. So we did those in-person events, but on a larger scale. We create online events. So we had online training for teachers, live primary school assemblies, so they could access these, again seeing different people, different scenarios, and then also like a few downloadable resources.
Okay.
There's
a lot there, and I don't want to diminish what you're doing, but in terms of the actual training you provide, it's through video form, right? So so film, and like with the film, what is it you're doing? You're providing like an understanding of like different cultures, different perspectives. Could you just what is it that what is the aim of the training, or what happens during that training?
So we use film as the tool during training.
Okay.
It's not just, you know, stick on a film and that does it.
That's why I was like, sorry if I sound like dumbed down the question, not at all,
because some people do think that.
Yeah.
So ultimately, if you ask me, how do you develop the skill of empathy? We've talked about why it's important. Research has also shown, like, there's an organization, Catalyst, in America that focuses on women in the workplace. They've done research that shows if you have an empathetic leader or manager, everything improves.
Yeah.
So retention improves. How much does it cost to recruit someone?
Oh, I mean, I don't actually know, but I know it's a lot.
It's a lot of money.
Especially
in big corporate, it's a lot of money. So even if you kept everyone in their job 3 months more, you would save, over a course of like 10 years, you would save hundreds of thousands.
Yeah.
So that's a no-brainer. People want to work for empathetic leaders. They're more values-based now. So they actually, you get higher talent wanting to join your company.
Yeah.
People who are off sick are off sick less and come back to work quicker.
100%.
Innovation increases.
Yeah.
Creativity increases.
Yeah.
Everything improves. Literally everything. So you want to develop that skill. And then the question is, okay, how do you develop it? Yeah. And that's the missing bit. So people know empathy is important and it can now deliver these big results. If you type empathy into Forbes now, if you look at like the history of articles, there wasn't many 2 years ago. Now there's almost like one a week.
Yeah.
Why? Because empathetic businesses and leaders and teams make
more
money because they're more productive, they're more innovative. The thing is, how do you get to that point? And so the most simple answer I can give is increase the amount and diversity of experiences you have. And people get empathy wrong. They think it's walking in someone else's shoes. The problem with that is, if you walk in someone else's shoes, if you put yourself in, if I put myself in your shoes, you're a black man, I'm a white man.
You can't.
You already know we've had different experiences.
Yeah. Right? He's also 6 foot plus and I'm not. So, you just can't put myself in my shoes.
Size 12, I don't know. Maybe we're same size feet, I don't know. But this is the problem people have. They think, okay, so if I put myself in your shoes, I could do that. And you know, your situation running a podcast, I could try and imagine myself doing that. And I could imagine myself in a tech job. But I'd be bringing all of my previous experiences into that. So I would still see, I'd see your world, but from a lens of 32 years of experiences.
Yeah.
So people then go, oh, well, why is empathy important? Well, it's important because you can get to a really good place of understanding. But actually, part of empathy is also understanding that I will never fully understand. And so what I have to do is keep you in your shoes, listen to you, and this is the crucial bit, believe you and your experiences, even if it doesn't match my own.
Yeah.
That's true, like, inclusion. That's true diversity, equity, inclusion. That's true belonging. That's true empathy. Yeah. And that's a really hard thing to do because everyone will be thinking of a time where someone's told them something and they're like, oh, that is bull, right? Or that's not true. Or it wasn't quite like that. And maybe it wasn't, but you have to sort of give that leeway. And if you can do that, if you can connect, you will have those better experiences. But how do you get those experiences? It's really expensive to fly around the world and meet people from different cultures and backgrounds. Film, we all know it. Film can take you from a place of like one emotional state to a completely different within seconds. Drop of music, change of tone, a story. Some charities have been doing it for years. And I always talk about the powerful nature of imagery as well. Yeah. I think the one that I always think about in terms of just an image is if you think about that picture of the turtle with the straw up its nose. Do you remember that?
I think I do remember it. I don't remember the actual image itself, but yeah.
That's changed the coffee industry or the takeout industry, right? Now everyone's got paper straws. It was almost off the back of that image, which made people like, why are we using so much plastic?
Yeah.
Why do we have plastic straws anyway? Why can't we change things? And that led to a massive change. So imagery can be so powerful in changing people's perspectives on things. And so we use film. And I film now 25 different people from Nepal, India, Mexico, UK, people that talk about microaggressions and race, to someone who's got Down syndrome, Cheeky Chappy James, who wears a t-shirt that says, chill out, it's only an extra chromosome. He walks around town and he's aware he's got Down syndrome. And I'm like, when was the last time you saw a film of someone who has Down syndrome?
And really like...
And talking about themselves. And they're it's usually like a charity. Or so they're like, so they're, you know, someone that cares for them.
Or it's like part of like a wider agenda. And what I mean by that is like, I saw someone with Down syndrome, but it was on like Love is Blind. And it's like part of like a subplot of like these two people
we must be inclusive.
And we'll do you know what I mean?
So it's done in like a really authentic way. And, you know, I speak to companies and they say to me like, you know, what problems are having? Or, you know, I've trained at a law firm and they were like, we've got a couple of women from a Muslim background that really feel unseen and not listened to. I said, do you know what? I've got perfect film. Lippa, shout out Lippa Nessa. Mm-hmm. She's amazing. She's a young youth activist, football coach. In her film, I filmed her, she's from Bedford, talks about the choice to wear a hijab. She was playing semi-pro football. And then one day she turned up to training wearing a hijab. And I showed this film at like in a law firm and I was like nervous because it was the first sort of law firm that I'd done training for. But they have to have empathy for their clients.
Yeah.
So how do they develop that skill? And then you get them having conversations.
Yeah.
And really we talk about our films as a Trojan horse. We watch a film now, it sparks conversation.
Yeah.
In the inside you don't see all the things that it's doing, but especially in schools as well, what it sparks are difficult conversations. It starts speaking about things that are maybe more personable. It gets people being vulnerable, and ultimately you lead into a conversation of the content. But what does everyone do when they see something or media? They start talking about it in relation to themselves. Yeah. And they don't even realize. So, you know, you then get people being like, oh, my neighbor's this or that. And what you start doing is learn about each other. Now, if you do that time and time again, it's like the gym.
Extrapolates out.
Yeah, I'm not the most hench. I do know that if you go to the gym once, nothing really happens.
Yeah, that's true.
And you don't even necessarily see it. But you look back in 6 months' time, if you go periodically,
yeah,
you see a difference. Yeah. It's kind of the same with empathy. You don't necessarily see that impact.
So, by the way, like, I've really heard you there. But my question is, I agree with you, right? Give it enough time, you will see the impact. How is it it's measured, right? Because you said that you've obviously done the study with the University of Cambridge. Like, how is it? Because it sounds a bit like opinionistic. I don't want to say that word.
No.
So do you have ways to tangibly measure the improvements?
Yeah. And I mean, depending on if you come from a psychological point of view or a neuroscience point of view, again, it's like leadership. How do you measure leadership?
Yeah.
How do you measure effective leadership? Do you wire up your brain? It's often in the other things. So we took what we call a mixed methods approach. So we had a quantitative survey, which was based off of like then a previous study that had been done. So you then take that and then you use the same sort of formulae of questions. And then we also did interviews. And then in the interviews, you look for like, again, trends and matching words and phrases. And you essentially take an approach. And of course, with all science, and especially with this sort of mixed methods approach, and leaning more heavily towards a qualitative side, so words and descriptions rather than direct figures, there's always, you know, errors, and there's always things that can be misinterpreted. But ultimately, you look for the trends, and ultimately, you look for the changes. So we asked teachers to measure, you know, through their own eyes and observations, has behavior improved? And that wasn't necessarily like, oh, because of the program. It's like, has behavior improved?
Yeah.
Do you think your children are more empathetic? Can you describe any situations? So it's those anecdotes that also add as evidence. Mm-hmm. But you're right, it is something that's hard to measure. Companies would measure it in terms of over time,
profitability, retention,
profit, sick days, things like that. So you can measure it in those. There are a couple of websites out there that's like, you know, measure how empathetic you are and you answer like 10 questions. I'm not really sure about that. Yeah. And also, how do you define empathy? Like, lots of people don't understand the word. People think it means kindness, yet people will also describe it as walking in someone else's shoes.
Yeah.
And both of those things for us, I always say kindness is often wasted without empathy. And a really quick example would be when I was teaching, I had a technician who helped me set up my science experiments for my class. And he was Muslim, but at Christmas, I gave him a bottle of wine and said, thank you very much for helping me. Yeah. One, he doesn't celebrate Christmas properly. And two, he doesn't drink. But he laughed. He laughed and went, Habibi. We had a really good relationship. But imagine the difference of me giving him some chocolates that I said, look, I've checked, these are halal. And I really appreciate all the effort you're putting in. And I've made sure you can eat these. And I know you don't celebrate Christmas, but have an amazing holiday. Wouldn't have taken me any more time. Probably have saved me a few quid. And he'd have been like, wow, he really gets me.
Yeah.
And I didn't make that mistake again. But, you know, it's those little tweaks that keep people in jobs and businesses and build those relationships.
So I've got so many directions I want to take this in.
Mm.
The first question, I always say this, like, I number them. I only ever number the first question and I just go off on a tangent. But yeah, what is like screaming out to me is like, do all businesses actually want to improve empathy, right? So you've just said something there like, I never made that mistake again. And it's like, you have a lot of self-awareness. Like, in this capitalist society that we live in, do people actually want to be more empathetic? Or like, is it like a PR thing where, oh my God, like, we've improved empathy? Like, from your experience, is it like a real genuine trend, I suppose, is my first question.
Yeah, it's a good point. I think people are going to be forced to move that way anyway, because I don't think young people who are the future workers want to work for a boss or work for someone that isn't 100%. Values-based, that 100%. Isn't people-based, that isn't understanding that, you know, the world is changing. So I think they'll be forced to. There's a great, there's a survey done every year by an American organization called Business Solver, and they do a like empathy in the workplace survey every year. And it talks about CEOs seeing the importance of empathy, but also like how people rate this. It's really interesting how people rate empathy, and they're seeing a decline in some places.
Yeah.
I think ultimately...
How do people rate empathy?
How do they, I think it's going down at the moment. Goodness. I think it's going down, or they're seeing the business. Because the thing is, empathy, patience decreases when you're stressed. Empathy decreases when you're stressed.
Yeah.
So if you have like a massive workload, you'll probably get, you know, when you're well rested and you've like, you've been to the gym and you've had the time to think, you've got time to be empathetic when you're like, right, deadlines. And I think this is the difference. People think that you know, empathy is impossible to master.
Yeah.
If anyone says they're like really empathetic, what they generally mean is they suffer from emotional contagion, which is like, if you cry, I cry. That's what they think empathy is.
I was just thinking in my head, I think I'm quite empathetic. I've got like, emotional like, contagion.
No, but it's like, do you know what I mean? If you see someone, people are like, you know, watching stuff on TV and they cry, and it's just like, maybe you've been in the same situation, but you don't understand what that person is actually thinking and doing, and you don't know enough about them to truly, you know, you're suffering from a bit of emotional contagion there.
Yeah.
And I think empathy is so hard to master because it really determines you spending time and listening to other people and getting their viewpoint, even if it's different from your own.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I'm sort of elaborating here on what you're saying, but I think ultimately it's got to be a must. But okay. I think the crucial thing here is you can be a leader and make tough decisions and be empathetic.
Yeah.
So in my organization, with the guys that work for me, I demand that they have high quality of stuff, like the output's high, that their input's high, that they work hard. But also, they've got a doctor's appointment, or if they want to go gym in the middle of the day, or they want to do Pilates or whatever, cool, because I trust them to do the work. But if they slip on it, I will pick them up. And likewise, I expect them to pick me up on it as well.
And you've just said like a key thing there that I think is missed in organisations, and it's probably linked to empathy, I think it's trust. Mm-hmm. And an old boss who I used to work for, I never forget, he came in and he was just like, you all have my trust, and it's up to you to lose it. Because I think like, this day and age, coming back to your point, people work 9 to 5, 9 to 6, and like nobody is productive for 8 or 9 hours of the day. Like you're productive in burst, but I feel like people have to feel like they need to busy themselves. But you know, shout out to my employer, like they give you the trust. And it's so funny, like when you were defining empathy earlier, you were like, empathy is the understanding that allows people to be their authentic selves. See how I already remembered that, because it like really sat there. Like, yes. And I was thinking like, at my work, I'm allowed to be my authentic self because I know that my manager trusts me. Shout out, Jack. Look, I got you, boy. But like, I was just as you said it, I was just like, I don't worry about, oh my God, if I'm not here at this time, oh my God, if I don't come at 9 o'clock, like I'm going to get in trouble. And like, that allows you to do your best work and just be yourself. Where, coming back to your point, there's so many people who are overworked, overstressed because people just have no understanding of day-to-day life. Like, we live in a hybrid environment. You got to take your kids to school. Yeah. Sometimes you got to like leave clock off early.
Sarah, my team, she actually doesn't live too far from here, but I'd missed her Slack message in the morning. She turned up to like the stand-up we have on a Monday morning online because we're remote. And then I saw, and we went around and said how, because we're a small team, only 4 of us, and she said how, and I was like, What are you doing here? I'm not saying this to make myself look good, just generally. You know, her godson's a really close friend had died suddenly at the weekend. I was like, you need to go to Luton. Like, what, you know, and there's no point thinking, your head's not here anyway. And also, like, there is nothing, there is, you're not going to think in 10 years' time, thank God I worked for Ed on Monday, that Monday. You know, just go and like take the time and just, it's just being human. It's just being like understanding. One of the things I do, so I was just in Germany this weekend and I was keynoting across I've never actually done it every day. So they had this conference, 22 German international schools, 400 teachers and educators from those schools. And I was leading. And the question I always ask, whether I'm doing a small group or a big group, is what's the most important thing happening in your life right now? And I ask it, and I use Slido, it's anonymous, and it comes up live. So we had hundreds of answers coming in. And some people are laughing because someone's put like their 61-year-old tortoise. Yeah. Someone's just put like, just got engaged, yeah, waiting my birth of my baby boy, or, you know, my marriage. And then you're like, you know, you don't know if that's positive or negative. And then someone's just put helping my husband through cancer. Looking after, you feel the, like, you, the room just goes, woof.
Yeah.
But it creates the sense of like, oh yeah, all of a sudden, you know, we're all in the same boat.
Mm.
We're all here to learn, and everyone's a bit nervous. They've got presentation, you know, there's 100 presentations next day. Some people presenting for the first time, all a bit nervous. I said, look, you got nothing to be nervous about. Everyone here is going through stuff. And some people are in a really good place of life, and some people are in a bad place. The thing about this is, if I ask you in a week's time, it will change, and it will continually change.
Yeah.
And that's when I then link what I said earlier, is like empathy is the skill to help navigate change better.
Yeah.
But that question, if you have a child, if you're listening to this, if you could ask that anonymously amongst your, or maybe not anonymously, but in your teams, you will learn so much about what's happening right then. And I used to do this as a teacher with a post-it note. So after a holiday or something like that, just write down what the best and worst part of your holiday was.
Yeah.
And you collect, like, empathy is like that skill to collect what I call human data.
Yeah.
So, oh, you know, oh, how many brothers and sisters do you have, or this, or what do you do? Is, you know, and you build up this picture of someone, because that allows you to connect, and that allows you to build trust.
And so that allows I you am to build empathetic. Now he said that, I believe I'm empathetic again. I do that.
But things like this, right? The amount of people you must meet.
Oh mate, it's been an absolute life changer.
So you're developing your empathy.
Yeah.
Through listening to people tell their stories, and an environment is also really important, right?
Yeah.
So having this chance, like, no distractions, just have a chat.
No phones.
Just listening to people asking questions. You're a perfect example of how you can develop empathy in your everyday life.
Oh, man, my man. So, like, to the people who are listening to this, like, whether it be like a parent, a leader at work, or even like an employee who's trying to level up at work, we've spoken so much about empathy. Like, what's an immediate next step someone can take to... yeah, like, hone the skill of empathy.
Your digital algorithm. Probably, you know, mine's filled with basketball cameras and all sorts of stuff. But we are fed so much advertisements and engagement and that sort of thing. So what I say is, like, right, read different newspapers.
Yeah.
You know, some get a lot of stick. But if you go to the readership of that one, they'll say, well, that one's this, and... understand what millions of other people that aren't in your demographic or aren't of your political leaning are reading and watching.
Yeah.
Because there are millions of them. And the reason we're seeing political divides and we're seeing so much division is, one, it's no obviously spun. There's no bridge of understanding. There's no bridge of empathy.
Yeah.
So if, at least you can still see what people are watching. You can still disagree with it.
Yeah.
So try and change up your algorithm a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Follow people that do different things. Go to different events that you would never otherwise go to. If you're into rap and hip hop or whatever it is, or if you're into soul music, go to a different genre.
Yeah.
If you like spoken word but you hate musical theatre, go and see musical theatre.
Yeah.
Go to a different part of town. If you live in London, you know, like, the differences between just tube stops.
Yeah.
In terms of communities, go to different things. The more you can experience different things, and over time, you know, I get the pleasure of meeting so many people as well. So I would like to think I'm quite empathetic, but it's, again, building it, and you still meet people and challenge your views.
Yeah.
I think the problem is, a lot of people live in, like, they've got a bubble around their head.
Yeah.
And it just needs to be popped every now and then. So think about, when are you popping that? When are you experiencing something that challenges you or is new?
I, like, agree with you so much. Mm. And, like, if you have the means, I know Ed touched upon it earlier, but, like, the importance of traveling and exposing yourself to different cultures, it really helps to, I don't want to say build empathy, but it gives you an understanding.
Oh, it does.
Like, I'll never forget, last January, I went to Kenya, and we're in the truck to, like, the safari park. And as you're driving through, it's 35 degrees, and, like, you see people in huts, that are this high. There's no electricity. You see people drawing water from a well where there's literal animals standing and there's feces, and like, this is their everyday. No electric. It's hot. They can't get out of the sun. They can't, like, they don't know where their next meal is coming from. Also, like, there's bloody lions. There's like lions, bruv, elephants.
But they're probably still wave and smile at you.
Yeah. And it's like, when you're like, bro, I ain't got nothing to worry about, man. It's like, it really helps to put into perspective any problems that you're going through in your life. And don't get me wrong, like, everybody has their own problems. But like, if you're in the UK, you're good. You're good to an extent, I'm telling you, because what happens in some of these less developed countries, it, until you see it, you just can't even picture
the
it.
The opportunities that we have. And again, it's again, and then that changes your whole, the way about you live your life. You change to a positive mindset. You go, you're like, right, I've got to make the most of this. I remember being in Iganga in Uganda, just walking around again with Tina, and because I'm a white man, and this shows like the colonialism and all sorts of problems with it, whatever. But this guy just comes up to me and he's got this piece of paper. And he shows me, and he's like, can you get this for me? And I'm like looking at it, and it's some sort of like massive machinery of like for key cutting or something bizarre, or like something to do with posts. And I'm like, no. And he's looking at me as like, why can't you get it? You're like white, sort of like, you should have connections. And I was like, I'm so sorry, I can't. I have absolutely no idea what that is or what it is. But that put for me, I remember that moment so vividly because it just showed how people viewed me. And I've been to like a lot of countries, and I realized that, like, you know, in Nepal, people will stare at you.
Yeah.
Like when you're in like a rural Nepal. In India, they will like come up and like touch you. And then in Uganda, they'll like shout at you. Yeah. And they'll just be like, they won't care. They'll just be like, hey, hey. But like, from that, I've experienced, you know, what it must, in some respects, you know, being an outsider for the first time. So traveling does that. You know, if you go to Asia or you go to other places, like, you experience being an outsider. And some people, unfortunately, will feel that, you know, here. In the UK, feel that here.
100%.
But in some ways, the UK is also one of the most diverse places in the world. And
or London. Culture. Or Star London. Star.
Or London. Yeah. Maybe not Dorset.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, it's like that point on travelling. Just tasting different foods. Appreciate, you know, China, this is like such a like obvious example, but like they eat dogs. And like here, that is like...
It's frowned upon, yeah.
You know, you're the devil, right?
Yeah.
But... And you can still say that is awful and evil or whatever you want to call it, but you should still go and speak to people or meet people in China and ask why they do it.
Yeah.
And things. And you can still disagree with them, but you will get a better understanding of culture. Yeah. And they'll look at you and be like, why are you eating that thing that's really weird?
Well, yeah. I was speaking to a friend who's just been to Japan, and I think they eat frog. And apparently frog tastes like chicken.
So like I've never eaten frog. I've eaten snails in France, but the French eat frogs as well.
Yeah, apparently it tastes like chicken. So you heard it here first. There's so there's so much to unpack. Like, we've spoken about like what people can do, and you've said, like, expose yourself, you know, to different situations, and take yourself out of your comfort zone is the way I've taken that. For leaders in organizations, really trying to become more empathetic, do you have any specific advice that you typically give to them?
Yeah, I think being a leader is hard, and I think it's seen as like this gold standard and everyone wants to get there. And then you get to that sort of position, realize that managing and leading people is really difficult.
Yeah.
I think if you want to have a culture of empathy, when I go to conferences or a speak or a keynote or whatever, you see the people that are being managed that maybe are in entry-level positions, they go, thank God he's going to tell our leaders to be more empathetic. And then the leaders are there and they're going, thank God he's going to tell everyone else to be more empathetic. And empathy has to go always, right? It has to go up, down, left, right, diagonal, cross. You can't have empathetic relationships with it. So there is a responsibility on leaders to create a culture of empathy and go, look, I'm going to understand, try and be as understanding of you, get to know you, etc. But also that's on people that are being line managed as well. But what's different about leaders is they have the role model.
Yeah.
So that's the difference. So if you are, and this can be done in a simple way, doing a gym session at 11 a.m. If you're saying to your staff, you know, we have a God, my voice, that used to happen all the time when I was teaching. Can you imagine teaching the U Gang? Your voice breaks. What was I saying? Yeah, so you have to role model.
At 11 a.m. Yeah, role model.
Yeah, and you say, you know, we have that approach at work, but you never take that time. You never take time for yourself. Or you never gym, or you never do anything. Take that time. Everyone else is going to be scared to like, well, is that really the culture?
Yeah.
Am I going to get like
scolded,
or like said, why am I not working hard enough for going to a gym session at lunch, which is going to run over by half an hour?
It's a bit like unlimited time off.
Take as much time off as you want. Yeah,
but if you actually do, that's,
I hate that policy. I just think people want boundaries, and they want to know where they fit, and there has to be some flex on those. But yeah, I would say for leaders, and also vulnerability comes up a lot, and I think, you know, a lot of leaders then go, oh, and I'm like, no, you don't have to be completely openly vulnerable about everything. You can be vulnerable to a certain degree. Work is also a place of refuge for a lot of people,
yeah,
where they don't want to be vulnerable. Where they can be vulnerable to a certain extent, but they also have boundaries, and they keep, and that's okay for some people as well. Like, yeah, you don't have to share everything about your whole history and all the things you talk to your therapist about at work.
Mm.
Like, work also has to have some boundaries. So it's about finding that balance, but really that's where the empathy bit comes in. It's understanding, how does Jerry want to be talked about compared to Sandra, compared to Jerome or whoever?
Yeah.
How leadership is not, what is my leadership style and how am I going to be a leader? It's how does everyone want to be led?
Yeah.
That's what effective leadership is. And that's the difference between, you know, I was at this conference again on the weekend and people were going like, well, what's the most important traits for a leader? I said, really what we should be doing is going, what are the traits that I want to be led by? And then if the leader knows those things,
then they can
do it.
Yeah.
I always remember when I was playing basketball at uni and our assistant coach, he was the army basketball coach at the time, and he pulled me aside at half time and he shouted in my face like this close, you know, when you get spit all over your face.
Yeah.
And he was a lot smaller, so it was more like in my chin. Shout out Ali. Alleyway. But he shouted at me and that pumped me up, and then the second half I played really well, and I remember we were in the pub, you know, a few weeks later, I said, why did you do that? You know, you've done it to a couple of other guys, but why do you not do it to everyone? And he said, well, I knew that it would pump you up.
Yeah.
And the next time you go to catch the ball, you're not going to be nervous about catching the ball. It's going to get your adrenaline going. If I did that to someone else, they would just drop the ball the whole next time.
As you've said that, I think that's like going back to the teaching. You can't teach all kids the same. And I think sometimes, like, even when I look back at like my past, a lot of teachers try to impose themselves on the children rather than understanding.
Yeah. My way or the highway.
Yeah. Yeah. And just listening to you, it sounds like, they just need to take like the empathy training. I'm just like, we've been going and I'm loving it. What I wanted to ask next is like, you mentioned a lot of reports. Are there any like just standout stats or that you can speak on with regards to empathy or how improved empathy leads to better outcomes?
Yeah.
I'm really putting you on the spot.
I want to do, again, one that is probably the most, when people say like, what is the power of empathy and what does that actually do as a skill and what can it lead to? And the ultimate answer is world peace.
Yeah.
It's a big one. But the reason I say that is because a little anecdote for you. It's not a stat. It's just a very powerful, obvious, evidence-based story based on what the outcome's been. There's this lady, Jo Berry, who I always use as an example. She's a friend and now an ambassador of the work that I do as well. And her father was killed in the IRA bombings in 1984,
yeah,
which killed, I think, 4 or 5 people. Her father was a politician. He was killed from this bomb attack in Brighton. The man that planted the bomb, Pat McGee, was released on the Good Friday Agreement. And since that sort of time, they have now shared a stage like this over 300 times. Whoa. She has sat next to the man that planted the bomb that killed her father. Now, I don't know anyone that could really do that, but the backstory to that is like, after he was released, through kind of meetings, they met, and Pat talks about the sincere empathy that Joe had for Pat. Not agreeing, not like meeting him with kindness, not saying, oh, you know, well done, you killed my father. Obviously not. Like, distraught, you've killed my father. But wanting to understand why. Who are you? What did you do it for? You know, but in a calm way, in a collected way. And Pat said for the first time, it was, he saw the humanity and the destruction of humanity that he had caused from his actions. Because for him, he was doing something to free his people, right? An action that he thought was for the greater good, sacrificing himself and all those sorts of things in a way to achieve a goal that he thought was actually necessary to stop what to get what he wanted for his people. Mm. And all of a sudden he's been met by this woman who's directly affected clearly by his actions, and they just talk about the power of empathy and bridging peace, and there is no conflict, there is no desperate situation in society right now, whether talking about Gaza or Lebanon or Sudan or Venezuela, all of these issues, and some of them that don't get any press and any attention, where empathy is not a central part of the solution. Yeah. I think empathy is a central solution focused skill, and that trumps all stats that I can throw at you around what we've reported or whatever. It is that it is fundamentally a very difficult skill, but if you can grasp it and use it, you can turn enemies into friends, you can overcome the most serious of issues and the most serious of atrocities.
Yeah.
And I think we need that more than ever at the moment.
I love it. Mate, that was so powerful. I was so engaged. I lost my train of thought. No. Okay, no. So sorry, I've got it. So on that, and you've kind of just said it there, like, what is your ultimate mission with Empathy Week and Empathy Studios?
Upskill everyone in the skill of empathy, because it's going to be the thing that helps everyone live a more successful, happy life. So I'm driven predominantly in the education space, because that's where my
background is,
and the power of if you can develop with Empathy Week, we talk about building an empathy generation. Imagine some of the students now that see 65 films from the age of 5 to 18.
Yeah.
They'll have met through film every type of religion, race, creed, gender, all people with different ideas. They go out into the working world, which is now globally diverse. You know, you can be on a call from someone from New York or someone from Shanghai or wherever, having to work with all people from different backgrounds, and they're able to navigate that. Excuse me. That is ultimately the main goal. If we can build this skill of empathy into the fabric, fabric of future leaders, we will have less war.
Mm-hmm.
We will have politicians that lead with heart and human decisions. Doesn't mean they don't make tough decisions, but they see the human rather than maybe just the stats, and they do stuff with a human first approach. That is ultimately the goal.
I love it. A lot of it seems like, let's focus on the kids of tomorrow because they're going to be leaders. As you speak there about like leadership, I don't want to say the person's name out loud, but what about those people who like are in the world at the moment and don't understand empathy? Like, is there any breaking through to them? And I'm thinking about people who have, you know, led protesting in our country and people who are leading protests in other countries against, you know, different races, mm-hmm, ethnicities.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Is there a way that we can break through to people like them?
I think it's got to be a collective effort. I think some people, it's going to be really hard to get through to them in that approach. We just have to hope that the good guys
win.
Always win, like Star Wars.
Yeah, I hear you.
But I think that's where the skill of empathy is important, because we want to fight fire with fire. You see someone that you vehemently disagree with, and you hate what they are saying. If you go with hate and you go with fire at them, they're just going to fire it back.
Yeah.
Da, 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 and that's what we're seeing.
Yeah.
If you go to, you know, some people that we won't name maybe, but we can maybe assume we know who we're talking about, you can say, why'd you do what you do? Or what? Talk to me. Are you open? Tell me all the things that you want. Let them speak.
Yeah.
And that might seem like a soft approach, but actually, you know, FBI interrogators, empathy is their number one tool of getting people to stand down and de-escalate situations.
Yeah.
I've listened to you. I hear you. I see you. We can maybe solve the problem that you're saying. Or make you realize the problem that you think it is, if it's race or whatever, isn't actually the problem. The problem's here. Something Why don't we else. Team up? Because it is something else. It's not what they think it is.
Yeah.
So the skill of empathy is needed in the majority of us to be able to connect with these people,
yeah,
whether we like them or not. and ultimately, you know, in schools there's a lot of leaning now towards behavior practices called restorative justice, which is like, okay, you've punched me in the face, usually, right, you're done, detention, done. Yeah. See ya. I never want to talk to you again. But actually, it's like, right, well, why have you done that?
Yeah.
And I get to understand that. And that's not being soft. You still get the punishment.
Yeah, exactly. I was about to say,
You're not let off.
Okay, yeah.
But actually, why have you done what you've done? And from a teacher's point of view,
you could safeguard against the next time almost.
Safeguard against the next time and change it. And
I love it.
Why are you an angry young man? There's something going on.
Yeah.
The behavior does not, there's always a reason for behavior. There's never an excuse.
Yeah.
So I need to find out what the reason is, because I can stop that from happening next time. And the excuse bit, there's no excuse, so you still get the punishment, but next time it won't happen.
Yeah, I get that. No. The final thing in this section, like, we've spoken about empathy, right, in the workplace. And, like, in the tech industry, it's happened a lot this over the last couple of years. There's been a lot of layoffs, a lot of people losing their jobs. To like the HR practitioner who's in charge of like letting people go, can they do it with empathy? Like, I've been part of a process where I was made redundant a few years ago, and it was not an empathetic process. If I had to like speak personally from my experience, I came away from the experience feeling discarded, feeling undervalued, feeling, yeah, like worthless almost. To HR people, because it's obviously such a difficult thing to have to do, how is it they can use empathy to turn a negative situation into like a neutral stroke or win, I suppose is the question.
It's, you know, people say, oh, we've got, especially if you're in a big company, oh, we've got such massive numbers. We're laying off 1,000 people. Doesn't matter. You can still have a human approach to it. I think I saw it happen in COVID. I can't remember the name of the company.
They did it all on Zoom.
Well, yeah, there was something that was leaked, and or like it was even just a letter. Awful. But on the flip side, there was another organization that went, look, we've hit a really tough time. We can't keep everyone. And it's breaking us. But here is a list of all these amazing people. And they're up for jobs. And if you're in a position, you should be hiring them.
Yeah.
What an amazing way 100%. To like handle that. Like, speak to your staff and go, well, you're obviously losing your job. What is it you would like to work in? Where would you like to work? What sort of roles? We can collect that information very quickly. We could create a database and put it out there to all the other companies.
Yeah.
Now, why won't they do that? Because there's a lot of ego in companies, and there's a lot of like, oh, well, we're losing it. You're losing your talent anyway because you're letting them go. So why not help them onto the next step, and also signpost and help other companies, and then be seen as and then when you regrow again, if you have the capacity to do that, what an amazing employee, somewhere that I know that even if they get to the tough times, they'll help me onto the next step.
Yeah.
Like, that's just an idea that I had, but that's doable. That's not
difficult. I think some people need to hear it, and that's why I said it.
Yeah.
To date, you've been around for about 5 years, I believe. How many people has empathy impacted?
Yeah, I say this number and I don't really like, because I'm so in it all the time, but Empathy Week has reached 1.3 million students across 54 countries.
Wow.
To date, and our program has been, like our film program, which is a more intense thing, has been completed by 175,000 students.
Wow.
Yeah, a lot of countries as well.
And yeah, where do you see empathy and yourself in the next 5 years?
I
call it the manifest corner.
I'm obsessed with it, really. I think it's so interesting. I think learning about different people's lives is so interesting. I think navigating change, I think being able to connect with people from different backgrounds is so interesting. I always think anyone that's got a phobia or ism of anything, if they just sit with the person that they're scared of or hate or whatever, and just listen, often they haven't ever met someone like that. Mm-hmm. And that's why they have this fear. And we have a fear of the unknown anyway. So what I hope to see is that Empathy Week is like an international
empathy event. Life. it's every day, genuinely.
I was saying to I think it was Lipa who I made a film of and who helped host the Empathy Week live show. We were chatting before the last one. We were like, why not Wembley? Why not 90,000 kids?
Yeah,
in a massive stadium, experiencing live film, live music, hearing people's stories, empowering others, leaving with conversations. What an incredible thing! And I think, why couldn't we go even more international to the point where this, and from a policy point of view, getting empathy, emotional regulation, emotional health skills into a curriculum that changes education? Because at the moment, I'm not one of those people like completely crush the curriculum and throw academics out the window, right? Because actually everything's a brick and it's all layered, and people that go, oh, trigonometry, I never use trigonometry.
Yeah,
but it allowed you to learn something, you know, it's all skills-based learning.
Yep.
But what we do need to do is lessen the pressure on academics, lessen the pressure on inspections, increase the amount of time for well-being, art, like all the stuff we enjoy that we pay our money for is being quashed.
Yeah.
Right? Art, music, theatre, cinema, they're all like going out of business.
Yeah.
What are we going to do with our time?
Yeah.
And then all the artists are broke, right?
Yeah.
Filmmakers, and everyone does it because we're out of a passion. So I would like to see us impacting the education space on a level where we are speaking to the Department of Education and saying, look, we've got evidence now. We know this works. Look at all of our, look at these schools that have been doing this 4 or 5, or, you know, in 10 years' time, they've been doing this 10 years' time. Yeah. Look at the impact, because that's what we need to do. We ultimately need to be in a position where we're helping young people have the best life they possibly can.
Yeah.
And I think empathy is not the answer to all of that, but it's definitely a fundamental, foundational role.
I love it. And finally, to the listener who's gotten to this point, if there's one thing you want them to take away from this conversation or a piece of advice you'd like to give, what would it be?
I think I'll keep it simple. I'll go back to what I said. Increase the amount and diversity of experiences yep. that you can have. Because that in itself will do things that maybe you didn't realize. It might spark a new passion in you. It might give you a different perspective on your own life. Well, I'm sure it will. And that is so valuable. So go out, speak to different people, learn from different experiences, go traveling if you want, if you have the privilege to do that, watch different films, just experience things differently.
We do have a quick fire round.
Yeah.
This has been such a great conversation. You ready for it? Reach 1 million students in one country or 100,000 across 100 countries?
1,000,001.
Focus on developing cognitive or emotional empathy?
Cognitive.
Could have said both.
It's harder. It's harder.
Empathy as a standalone subject or integrated into all subjects?
Integrated.
Curriculum focus on local issues or global challenges?
Depends on age.
Okay. Money or happiness?
Happiness.
Work from home or work from the office?
Home.
Would you rather travel to the past or future?
Past.
Who has it easier, men or women?
Man.
good. And then finally,
I'll be dead before I go outside. There'll be someone who'll be like, oh.
And then, yeah, dream dinner guest.
Do you know what I'm going to say? This just because I miss him a lot and haven't seen him for hours. Pankaj.
Oh, love it. Ed, this has been such a great conversation. We do have a closing edition on this podcast. With all of the experiences that you've been through and knowing what you know now, what advice would you give your younger self, and would you still be doing the same thing?
The advice I would give is try things and don't overthink it. Don't think, what am I getting out of this by doing this? Do it because of your curiosity. Do it because you want to do it, and actually ignore, especially when you come into your 20s, ignore kind of what everyone else is doing, because it'll probably be all the same stuff. So take a risk. You've got time to take a risk. Take a chance and do something you're passionate about, because the worries about money and things, you'll find a way. I had to move home twice. I moved home when I was 30, you know, only 2 years ago, and I'm only like back in London sort of 8 months properly. Had to do it to follow what I wanted to do, my passion and dream. So don't overthink things. Do it, try it, fail, keep failing, learn, but just lead with curiosity. And yeah, I think I would probably end up in the same thing that I'm doing now, because I've just followed my natural intuition and curiosity.
Ed, I love it. Yeah, this has been such an insightful conversation. And yeah, I hope to the listener, yeah, they can just take steps to try and become more empathetic. Where can people learn more about you, learn more about Empathy Studios, Empathy Week?
So my handles are at Ed Kerwin, and then Empathy Studios is empathystudios.com, and then empathy-week.com. So that's, the websites have all the info.
I'm looking forward to running this back in a few years time to seeing where we're at.
Yeah, let's do it in Wembley.
In Wembley. Yeah, 100%, nice. Man. But this has been such an amazing conversation. If you've gotten to this point in the episode, you know what to do, guys. Like, subscribe, share, comment. This one has been all about empathy. Yeah, this has been another episode of What My Best Friend Does. Now go and take some immediate action. Yeah, that's it. Over and out.